University professor Lawrence Gostin, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Laurie Garrett, and Brown University professor Adia Benton. Thanks so much for being with us. That does it for the show. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltzer, Amate Nermin Sheikh, Steve Martinez, Sam Malkoff, Hani Masood, Rabbi Karen, Dina Gesder, Amy Littlefield. Special thanks to Julie Crosby and Becca Staley. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Our website, democracynow.org.
This is KBOO Portland. The time is 5 p.m.
KBOO is getting ready for our annual book and record sale coming soon, and we are accepting donations now. The sale will be held sometime this fall. The book and record sale is a great way to help contribute to your community. So do us and yourself a favor. Clear out those books, comics, DVDs, VHS tapes, LPs, and CDs collecting dust around your abode and bring them down to the station. 20 Southeast 8th Avenue during our business hours. Got questions? Contact Jesse at 503-231-8032, extension 213, or online via email, volunteer@kboo.org. Remember, the stuff that you're sick of, others may treasure. Turn your clutter into cash for your community radio station, KBOO.
KBOO Community Radio and Sante Aesthetics and Wellness are proud to co-sponsor A Touch of Portland 2014. The event takes place Sunday, September 7th, and is a great way to detox after a long summer. Whether you're getting back from Labor Day weekend or decompressing from the burn, this is a great way to stay healthy through dance, foods, and multiple healing modalities. That's A Touch of Portland, Sunday, September 7th at Northwest 17th and Davis. Go to kboo.fm/touchofportland for more information on this event.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, police in Missouri have named the officer who shot and killed Michael Brown in Ferguson last weekend.
The World Health Organization has said that the spread of the West African Ebola epidemic has been vastly underestimated.
The European Union has allowed arms deliveries to Iraqi Kurds fighting against Islamic State militants in northern Iraq.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, August 15th, 2014. I'm Paul Rowland.
And I'm Linda Olson Osterlund. Texas Governor Rick Perry has been indicted on two felony charges for abuse of power and coercion of a public servant. The case stems from a veto that Perry issued last year for the funding of Travis County's Public Integrity Unit. Prior to issuing the veto, Perry had threatened to veto the funding unless the district attorney for the county resigned. The Public Integrity Unit investigates and prosecutes public corruption and malfeasance. But the district attorney heading the project was a political enemy of Rick Perry. Perry tried to force her to resign, and when she did not, he used his power as governor to veto the funding for her project. If she had resigned, Perry would have been the one responsible for finding her replacement.
The St. Louis Police Department has named Darren Wilson as the officer responsible for shooting and killing unarmed teen Michael Brown on August 9th. The police officer who murdered Michael Brown claims that he was assaulted by the teen and that he was hospitalized for facial swelling. The press conference turned into a town hall as angry citizens began asking the police questions and demanding answers. The police department used the long-awaited press conference announcing the name of the officer to make unsubstantiated claims that Michael Brown had been a suspect in a robbery. They presented four still photos from surveillance footage of the alleged robbery, none of which showed the suspect's face. The family of Michael Brown said that this action by the police was a smear campaign against their dead son, adding insult to injury. Hours after the press conference, the police chief quietly admitted to journalists that even if Brown had been a suspect in the robbery, the officer who shot him, Darren Wilson, did not know that when he stopped Michael Brown for allegedly walking in the street.
From the recent uprisings in the city of St. Louis to the crisis in Gaza and Iraq, questions are being raised about how far government should go in allowing the militarization of local police. What does this mean for ordinary citizens? KBOO's Sequoia Wright spoke with David Swanson with the peace and conflict resolution organization WorldBeyondWar.org.
With the recent events that have been happening in St. Louis, Missouri, Ferguson, Missouri, is that the reason for having a military-like presence in St. Louis, Missouri?
I don't think there's a good reason. I think there is, essentially the reasons that Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Presented us with years ago. There is militarism and racism and extreme materialism, and it's a toxic mix. And this is a town with a racist history and a country with a racist history, and a country that has for over a decade now been told it's on a permanent war footing, and we are to lose our liberties in the name of war, even as we cheer for the wars and scream freedom, which is a contradiction I've never been able to understand how anybody can believe these wars are for freedom when we always lose our liberties in the name of the wars. And so it is not just a local problem. This is a problem being pushed on localities culturally and financially by Washington, D.C. I think that when police are trained to view the public as potential threats, as potential terrorists, as potential enemies, and in particular to view activism as sort of low-grade terrorism, as threat to law and order, then you no longer have police trying to serve people. You have police trying to defeat people in a contest of power and strength. This is what we're seeing. We're seeing police trained to take on the public as an enemy. And when people gather in large numbers and hold rallies and demonstrations, that is viewed as a particular threat by the police. And so our most fundamental rights, our right to free speech and assembly and to petition our government for a redress of grievances, are stripped away as if they are minor offenses, and in some cases major offenses worthy of lethal power in police response. Whereas, of course, when it comes time to advertise the wars abroad that justify all of this, they are supposedly fought for defense of these very rights. So we are told to lose our rights in the name of war, while the war is launched in the name of these rights. And it's a very tough situation, because low-income communities, racially minority communities, are disproportionately taking part in the military, are most heavily recruited by the military, and many people have few options economically other than to go into the military. And of course, then there is identification with the military. And so it becomes hard to tell people that the problem is militarization itself, as Dr. King told us. Instead, people want to believe that there's been a misstep, there's been some slight excess, there may be one particular weapon that shouldn't be allowed, local police. No, I think we need a radical departure from the idea of police treating citizens as enemies.
Do you think that we are in the beginning stages in a police state?
Are we in the beginning stages of a police state?
Yes.
I think without a doubt there is ground to call this a police state. When we spend much more money on locking somebody up than we spend on educating them, when we spend more money just on recruiting someone to join the military than we do on educating them, when we are locking up a far greater percentage of our population behind bars than any other country on earth, and have additional huge numbers of people in the justice system in terms of parole and probation, we're not a free society. We're not the least free society on earth, but we are far from the most free society on earth. And we're moving in, by many measures, in the wrong direction. We're investing more heavily in police, and we're investing in police as if they are war forces. I mean, to impose a no-fly zone over a foreign country and the bombing that entails is bad enough, but to begin imposing no-fly zones over U.S. cities and towns and neighborhoods like Ferguson, Missouri, so that people can be, if necessary, controlled from the skies, is outrageous. It follows a pattern that we see in President Obama's policy of murdering U.S. citizens with drone strikes, as well as so many non-U.S. citizens. And it's unbelievable to me the extent to which people are sitting back and taking it. And so the protests and the attention around the killing in Ferguson, Missouri is encouraging, and we need more of it.
All right. Thank you, Mr. David Swanson. And I'm Sequoia Wright for KBOO Evening News.
A group of postal workers protesting the privatization of the post office in Portland have had their charges dropped after being arrested in two separate protests in recent months. One of the protesters, John Schweibert, said that he suspects the authorities dropped the charges because the arrest led to increased publicity spotlighting waste, fraud, and abuse at the U.S. Postal Service. Two actions generated the federal charges: a demonstration on a postal loading dock last December, protesting the scheduled closure of the Springfield, Oregon mail processing plant, and the blocking of a private truck contracted to transport the U.S. mail in July of 2013. The protesters say that dismantling the postal infrastructure leads to mail delays and revenue loss. Less than a month after the Springfield demonstration, which received national press coverage, the Postmaster General announced he was suspending closures and consolidations of mail processing plants. 2013 saw the closure of 141 plants, half the mail processing facilities in the nation, including the Salem, Oregon plant in June. According to protester Jamie Partridge, postal management is tearing apart the infrastructure of the U.S. public postal service. He said that he and other letter carriers plan to escalate this fight to save, quote, our national treasure, the U.S. Postal Service. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin, followed by Bread and Roses at 6. Tonight, Bread and Roses welcomes outdoors educator, filmmaker, and activist Miho Aida to discuss her project, If She Can Do It, You Can Too, which focuses on the representation of women of color. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's Hard Knock will speak with former Black Panther Party member Elaine Brown on the St. Louis, Missouri crisis. Weather on Saturday is mostly sunny with a high of 83 degrees and a low of 60. Sunday is also sunny and a high of 84 and a low of 61 degrees. Today in history, on August 15, 1969, the Woodstock Music Festival opens on a patch of farmland in the upstate in New York town called Bethel. The festival became a documentary in the 1970s, and it was known as America's 1960s youth counterculture at its best. KBOO will sponsor a showing of the director's cut of Woodstock at the Clinton Street Theater this Monday. Check out our website, kboo.fm, for more information. And the quote of the day is from Eleanor Roosevelt: "We gain strength courage and confidence by every experience in which you really stop to look fear in the face. You are able to say to yourself, I live through the horror. I can take the next thing that comes along.
It's 5:13. Let me restate that. It's 5:14. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Attention shoppers, if you're looking for a super buy, be sure to check out the Family Pack. This is not a gross of toilet paper rolls packaged in plastic wrap, but a newly invented political money scam. It lets the rich families of congressional candidates dump gross amounts of money into their darlings' campaigns, bypassing the $2,600 legal limit they can give as individuals. Both Republicans and Democrats are using this Family Pack loophole, another gift from the Supreme Court's ridiculous decree that money is speech. By definition, that perversion of language and nature by the court means that speech is not free, but a commodity to be purchased in bulk by those who have the most money. For example, Gabriel Rothblatt, running for Congress as a Democrat in Florida, is being backed by a supposedly independent PAC that, so far, has raised $225,000 to speak on his behalf. The law says that these outside campaigns cannot coordinate in any way with the candidates they support, and Rothblatt plays along with this joke by insisting that he has no idea where this PAC came from or what it's doing. How strange, since every dime of the PAC's funding came from Gabriel's mom. He says that her financial backing and the speech she's buying for him is a total surprise, for it never came up in family conversations. Likewise, Republican Senate wannabe Ben Sasse is backed by a Family PAC funded entirely by his rich granduncle. And GOP Senate nominee Dan Sullivan in Alaska is supported by a PAC getting the bulk of its money from his family and their business associates. This is Jim Hightower saying, why would we want anyone in office who uses such a blatantly corrupt ploy, then, with a big wink, insults us with the I had no idea lie? To help stop this money game, go to mayday.us.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at hightowerlowdown.org.
The U.S. Drug Enforcement Agency spent almost $1 million of taxpayers' money to obtain passenger manifests from Amtrak employees. The DEA paid an Amtrak secretary more than $854,000 to inform adult passengers. Ironically, because Amtrak, formerly known as National Railroad Passenger Corporation, gets billions in U.S. subsidies, they are subject to the Freedom of Information Act. That means the DEA could have had all the information it needed for free.
Portland and Beaverton school districts are currently trying to move to antibiotic-free chicken. Until now, the cost of chicken raised without antibiotics has kept them off the menu at Portland and Beaverton schools. Currently, chicken costs about $1 per 2-ounce portion, which means that school meal programs can only offer it a few times a year. The aim is to get the cost down to 60 cents per portion, but Oregon currently lacks a poultry producer that can meet the demand. Chickens raised without antibiotics are not given antibiotics in their food, nor are the eggs or birds injected with antibiotics unless they're sick. The volume of antibiotics used in food animals is creating a public health crisis, according to Lance Price, a professor in the Department of Environmental and Occupational Health at George Washington University. Only about 20% of the antibiotics given to animals are used to treat sick animals. The rest are used as preventatives. Years of evidence shows that using too much antibiotics in animals can create resistant bacteria in humans, also called superbugs. According to School Food Focus, chicken is the most common protein used in school meals in the country.
And in another meat story, the meat filler known as lean, finely textured beef, or pink slime, made headlines back in 2012. At the time, the publicity led many well-known fast food chains to make the decision to not use the filler anymore. However, reports of drought conditions and the rising cost of beef has prompted some businesses and restaurants who had stopped using the meat filler to start using it again. One of the main producers of pink slime, South Dakota's Beef Products Incorporated, says it's reopening a plant it closed a few years ago. According to several media outlets, the production of pink slime has doubled since hitting rock bottom in 2012.
The Ebola virus continues its swift spread across four West African countries, including several major cities. The World Health Organization, or WHO, warned today that the magnitude of the Ebola outbreak, which has killed more than 1,000 people, has been vastly underestimated and will require extraordinary measures on a massive scale if it is to be contained. The admission came as Doctors Without Borders said the disease was spreading faster than the health community can respond and accused the WHO of being too slow to react. The outbreak started out small in a village the same way Ebola outbreaks have begun in the past. The first was 38 years ago in the Congo, next to the river that gave the virus its name. Previous outbreaks did their devastation in remote villages and were contained and then burned themselves out. But researchers say that this time there's a different pattern to the spread of the virus, and this is the worst Ebola outbreak in history. Washington-based researchers say that as the virus carves a path through West Africa, it is highly unlikely that we would see similar destruction here on the United States soil. They say that unlike the African countries involved, the United States has a strong public health system, plenty of hospitals, and standard infection control protocols. Also, the Ebola virus is not highly contagious, and transmissions require much closer contact than those viruses spread through air, such as influenza and the measles. In Ebola's recent spiral, the virus began infecting people in a remote forest region of Guinea, moving on to the nation's populous capital city of Conakry. After that, it spread to Sierra Leone, Liberia, and more recently, Nigeria. This is the first time Ebola has been identified on the west side of Africa. Medical teams from the Centers for Disease Control and Doctors Without Borders and other agencies are being dispatched to the region to try to bring the virus under control. No vaccine or cure exists for Ebola, although scientists at Washington State University and other labs are conducting research that could lead to a cure.
As the fighting in northern Iraq between Islamic State fighters and Kurdish militia groups continues, some analysts say that the U.S. has allowed the situation to get out of hand. In the past, killing of Kurds in Syria was ignored because many in the region and in the West were so focused on attacking the Assad government. Now the European Union has authorized arms shipments to the Kurds in Iraq, in addition to U.S. airstrikes against Islamic State militants. Edmund Garib spoke with KBOO's Sam Bauman today about how U.S. intervention in Iraq may further hurt the Iraqi people and fragment Iraq in the name of this humanitarian intervention.
So what does the recent intervention by the U.S. and other Western countries on behalf of the Kurds mean for Iraqi Kurdistan, given the history between the West and the Kurds?
Well, basically, this is going to be perceived as support for Kurdish national aspirations and for the hopes of the Kurds of Iraq for a self-determination to a large extent. I mean, this is a plus side because historically, as you mentioned, Iraq's policy towards the Kurds and Iran's policies brought external intervention into the conflict between the Kurds and the Iraqi government and a number of times in the 60s and the 70s. Perhaps the one in the 70s was the most significant because that was the period when the Kurds were ultimately dropped despite promises. And that's when former Secretary of State Kissinger made the statement that the U.S., when the Kurds demanded support, and he said that the United States was not in the business of doing missionary work.
What is the current likelihood? I mean, obviously things are changing every day, but the likelihood of Kurdish independence, and what would that mean if Iraqi Kurdistan was independent for Kurds in the neighboring countries?
This is actually a very important question. There's no doubt that if probably we had a poll tomorrow in Iraqi Kurdistan, I would say maybe about 80-85% of the population would say they would favor Kurdish independence. However, I think that while this is something that's well deserved, the Kurds as a people deserve the right to determine their own future. Nevertheless, there are some significant problems down the road. First, I think there are two important countries in the neighborhood which have large Kurdish populations. You have Iran, where actually at one time in the mid-40s of the last century, you had the only Kurdish republic to emerge in Kurdish history. However, it did not last more than a year or thereabout. And the reason was because the Soviet Union, which was supporting that republic, withdrew its support, and the United States and Britain supported the Iranian government to crush that republic and ultimately executed its leaders and many of the political figures who supported it. Interestingly, one of the main defenders of this republic was Mullah Mustafa Barzani, the father of Masoud Barzani, the current leader of the Kurdish region in Iraq today. And he ultimately played a major role in trying to help that that republic. And so there is strong link between the Kurds of Iraq and the Kurds of Iran. So Iran has about 9 million Kurds, and certainly it's not going to look with favor upon the creation of an independent Kurdish state next door, because its own Kurds are going to demand at least autonomy and perhaps down the road independence. The same thing applies to Turkey, a country which has for a long time oppressed the Kurds perhaps more than all the other states where the Kurds find themselves, and it has a huge Kurdish population of about somewhere between 18, 19 to 22 million Kurds.
For KBOO Evening News, this is Sam Bowman speaking with Edmund Garib, an internationally recognized expert on the Kurds and on Iraq.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to This Week in Palestine, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for July 9th to the 15th, 2014. On Friday, scores of civilians were treated for the effects of tear gas inhalation as Israeli troops attacked the nonviolent protests organized in West Bank villages. IMEMC's Majd Badjali has more.
Israeli soldiers attacked a nonviolent protest organized in the northern West Bank village of Kfar Kaddoum. According to local sources, residents along with international supporters were protesting near the Israeli-installed roadblock at the main entrance of the village when they were attacked by Israeli soldiers. The Israeli army closed the main road leading in and out of Kfar Kaddoum 13 years ago, claiming that it creates a security risk for the illegal settlements near the village. In the central West Bank, Israeli troops used tear gas and sound bombs as well as chemical water to attack the weekly anti-wall and anti-settlement protests at the villages of Bil'in and Na'lin and the nearby village of An-Nabi Saleh. In Bil'in and Na'lin, Israeli soldiers attacked the protesters as soon as they reached the gate of the wall that separates local farmers from their lands. Many protesters were treated for the effects of tear gas inhalation at both locations. Meanwhile, at the village of An-Nabi Saleh, troops attacked the unarmed protesters before leaving the village. Later, soldiers stormed the village and fired tear gas into residents' homes, causing damage. Elsewhere, at Al-Ma'sara village in southern West Bank, Israeli troops stopped villagers and their supporters at the entrance of the village and forced them back. However, no injuries were reported. For IMEMC News, this is Mansur Jal.
Indirect Palestinian-Israeli talks in Cairo resume as a five-day ceasefire is in effect. Although no breakthrough, yet there is some light at the end of the tunnel.
IMEMC's George Shmawi with the details.
As Palestinian and Israeli negotiating teams are holding indirect talks in the Egyptian capital of Cairo, residents of the Gaza Strip went to look for their missing beloved and the ruins of their demolished homes, with the hope that the death of over 1,950 Palestinians will not go in vain. Deputy Secretary General of the Palestinian faction of the Islamic Jihad, Ziad al-Nakhla, said on Thursday that a long-term ceasefire to include the lifting of the siege on Gaza would be announced soon, stressing that great progress has been made in negotiations. Palestinian media sources said that the announcement comes after Israel reportedly dropped its demand that Palestinian resistance groups inside Gaza disarm, while apparently acceding to the demands by the Palestinian delegation that the 8-year-long economic blockade of the Gaza Strip be lifted. Azam al-Ahmad, head of the Palestinian delegation, said an agreement is near and a meeting in Ramallah to update the Palestinian leadership with the latest progress of the negotiations will be held soon. According to al-Ahmad, some preconditions set by Israel have been dropped, such as disarming the resistance in Gaza. He added that there are few missing issues to finalize an agreement over the seaport and the airport and the total lift of the siege. Observers say Israel is under unprecedented pressure due to the high number of Palestinian civilian casualties and the repeated attacks against the UN schools in the Gaza Strip. After officials in the Obama administration say they were blindsided by the shipment of ammunition from the Pentagon to Israel, the administration decided to put a temporary halt on the transfer of a number of Hellfire missiles. The move appears to be a tit-for-tat response to the Israeli purchase of ammunition directly from the Pentagon, according to analysts familiar with U.S.-Israel relations. President Obama recently gave a speech assuring his administration's full support for the Israeli offensive in Gaza and authorized an additional $225 million approved by the U.S. Congress.